Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Your Owl Post for the week is freshly delivered, and I am just one of your hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is every single week, the one, the only, Drea Kaufman.
Hello, all.
Hi.
We were just talking about Rice Krispie Treats, and so just so everyone is very clear, I'm going to be thinking about Rice Krispie Treats the entire time we're doing this.
It's not.
I just want to set my expectations out there. I want to be my most authentic self, and that authentic self really needs a Rice Krispie treat.
Somebody Grubhub Andrea a Rice Krispie treat right now. Just do it. Just get her.
Just randomly get a Rice Krispie treat delivered to my house.
Yes. Do it. Somebody do it.
Oh my god, that would make my day, no joke.
Can you imagine, like, just somebody randomly sending you food right now, you know, from your favorite restaurant, and it shows up at your door and you're like, I don't know who this is from, but I'm having my best life now, so.
I know, right? I mean, I might be a little worried that it was poisoned or something, but I mean, if you're having it delivered by a delivery service, then by all means. I also want to know, how did you get my address?
Yeah. that's a good question. So we don't give out our address on the show, but we would like to encourage you to find us over on all the social media platforms. You can find us on Twitter at Join Nerd Party. You are on Facebook at facebook.com/the Nerd Party. So find us, like us, follow us, subscribe, all those things. You can get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. If you're on Apple Podcasts, give us a star rating and review. Make sure, again, you're subscribed to the show and you get it as soon as it drops. And then you can find us on thenerdparty.com, which got all of the different shows that we do. And you can also send us an email if you go to thenerdparty.com/contact. And you can send an email to Owlpost. So Drea and I will get that. Drea, in all of the chapters of this book, you know, last book we reached the chapter called The Last Prophecy, and it was a moment where a lot of things from the series become clear. And I would say chapter 23, called Horcruxes, is that same type of chapter in this book.
Yeah, this chapter really does have the crux of what we're talking about here. I didn't even mean to
mom
do that.
Mom joke.
But this is one of the most important chapters in the book. There is a fairly significant happening, one or two, as we wrap up this book. I'm not ruining it for anybody, but hopefully.
Wait, significant things happen in this book?
Oh, like the rest of these chapters are going to get, like, we're going to get real, yo. We're going to be super direct and candid here for a bit. But this is one of those incredibly significant chapters, because the last one ends with us learning that Harry has captured this super important memory that we spent the last 20 chapters trying to get. And this chapter is where we actually get to understand what it is. And they really break down Harry and his advantage and disadvantage and things like that. And I miss this. This is not in the movie. I mean, the memory is in the movie, but because of how important it is. But the rest of it is so, I miss it. It's one of those things, like, you don't know what you're missing until, you know, what is the phrase? You don't know what you have until you don't have it. This is one of those where, like, not having this part in the movie is huge. And it is so, such a great character building moment that we miss out on in the movie, and it makes me so angry.
Yeah. I mean, your anger right now is the same anger I have at that chapter, you know, The Lost Prophecy, as we were talking about that. So, yeah.
We're like this, man. We're like this.
Yeah. It's so funny because, you know, I'm right there with you in that. I feel that, and I felt the same way as I was reading this chapter. It's like, not only does it hurt this movie, but it also hurts because they kind of blow the end of the series in the movie anyway, because they turn it into, and I'm not spoiling it for anybody because everybody's probably seen the movies, but they just turn it into a big battle that it's not. The whole point is that it's not a battle by that point. Spoiler alert. And this chapter and what they talk about at the end is so pivotal to why that's why the book series ends the way it does. So yeah, I'm right there with you. You know, I really like the way the chapter begins because Harry's just getting back from Hagrid's. You know, he's got the memory, and his goal is really just to go back to his common room, and then he'll meet up with Dumbledore later because it's fairly late. And then he can't get into the common room because the portrait, the fat lady, will not let him in because apparently the password changes at midnight. And he doesn't know the new password. And she's telling him he'll have to sleep outside, which is ridiculous. And that's when we, you know, get Narrowly Headless Nick coming behind Harry and telling him that Dumbledore is actually there at the castle. And so Harry just kind of rushes off to go to Dumbledore's office to, you know, tell him the good news that he has the memory finally.
Yeah, it's so different than what happens in the movie, because I think in the movie he sort of waits until it seems more natural and more like, oh, we have our meeting, here you go. And this seems very more organic. Like, he's so excited, he's on high from actually succeeding, he finds out he can actually act on it. Like, we've all had that, like, oh my gosh, I want to do that right now. And you know, this is that happening. So I really love that it's more real. I do love too, this is again one of those things that was super sort of sterilized in the movies, is that most of his help in this chapter comes from a ghost.
Yeah.
Nearly Headless Nick is the one who tells him Dumbledore's back and he's in his office and he's not asleep yet, but you know, that sort of thing. And like, you can go see him essentially, just as his potion's wearing off, his biggest obstacle is not running into Peeves, right? The ghosts are characters in this book and in this chapter that we don't get in the movie really. So that always frustrates me and angers me a little bit. So I think that's just fueling my like uppityness about this chapter. But I do love that as he runs off, the lady in the portrait is like, no, I'm just kidding. The password's still the same. I was just annoyed you woke me up. And as a parent, I would totally do that to my kid. I'd be like, no, I'm just kidding. You can totally have that. You just pissed me off.
I love, you know, him getting into Dumbledore's office, and Dumbledore's kind of quite surprised that, you know, these days, like, man, it's kind of late. What you doing here? And he's just so excited. He's like, I've got the memory. And you get this moment where Dumbledore just gets this massive smile on his face. And he's like, Harry, this is spectacular news. And all I can think of was the phrase spectacular news. Ewan McGregor says that in the newest film from DC, Birds of Prey. All this is spectacular news. And like, he's saying it so excited. And that's all I could hear. I don't know why, but it has nothing to do with the chapter. Anyway.
Well, it's such a British thing to say.
Yes, it is.
Like, it's just so very British. And that's probably why it's resonating there, too. But yeah, he's like a kid in a candy store. He's like, I don't care that you're out of bed way late. Let's do this, man. Like, mm-hmm. He's like, I love, they even mention here, like, all of the sort of like weariness fades away and they're both sort of super entranced into like moving forward. They immediately want to review the memory. They immediately want to talk about it. And we get right into it. And it's so real, because just like his excitement to go share it to Harry, I would also be like, okay, let's listen to it. I want to know what I like, just that immediate satisfaction they're able to get after such long waiting is, I love how real it feels.
This memory is fascinating because obviously this is the unadulterated memory, and it's so interesting to see the way that it plays out. One of the things we see here is just how just how comfortable Tom is in his own skin. And in many ways, the way that he's kind of talking to Slughorn, the way that he's extracting information from him, Harry understands very well. And Harry even thinks to himself, wow, he's good. Because Harry has spent most of his time at Hogwarts with different professors and with different people in power, having to try to get information from them, and not in nefarious ways. You know, with all of the adventures that Harry has had here, he has definitely had to learn how to speak to others in power, but in a way that allows him to be able to get what he needs from them. And so he has a lot in common here.
In the corporate world, we call this influencing without authority.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
That is absolutely what he has to master here. And he even acknowledges that, I think he calls him a master of his craft.
Well, and at the same time, you know, what he's noticing is that, you know, Tom's not the oldest student here, but everybody looks at Tom as if he's the ringleader. And so that's also kind of interesting as well, because, you know, what did we see last year is that people began to look at Harry differently, especially with the Order of the Phoenix having started, Dumbledore's army having started. And so, you know, that just makes for a really interesting parallel as well. And we get all of the rest of the students leave, and Tom finally asks the question, this idea about Horcruxes. And it's interesting to me, and you can understand why Slughorn does not like this memory, because he basically just gives up the information like it's not good. Like he barely registers a complaint to talk about this in the first place until much later in the conversation. Otherwise, he's very cavalier with this information with Tom.
It's not quite as flippant as the movie makes it. He's not quite as like, oh, like overtly covering his tracks, right? Because in the movie, he's very like, oh, so jolly. You, this is just for study, right? And here he's a little more just forthcoming and conversational about it. And it isn't until he starts to feel uncomfortable with what he's sharing and until Voldemort kind of has to, or Tom, because he really is Tom at this point, has to sort of pull it out of him and rein it back a little bit. Does he start to do some of that like backtracking, right? He is much more a willing participant in this and not so much an afraid participant as they paint him to be in the movie. And so it makes you even more understanding of why he didn't want to share this full memory. Especially because we also find out from this memory that talking about Horcruxes at Hogwarts is something they're not allowed to do, and that Dumbledore is very, very adamant about that. That's like the one thing that your teacher, your parent has, it always makes them angry is how I took it, right? That one thing you know will always get you in trouble. I felt like that's kind of the feeling associated with this topic. You know, it's so interesting, but we also learn a lot about how they work, like a lot more than we do in the movie. And it doesn't take up that much time.
Yeah, what we learn here is that to create a Horcrux, one must rip their soul. And to do that, one must commit an act of unspeakable evil, committing murder. And that by doing the killing that rips the soul apart, and then you are able to encase that portion of your soul into an object, which Slughorn admits he does not know what that incantation is, and don't even ask him. Why would he know? And so Riddle takes this even further by asking, you know, well, wouldn't it be more prudent, basically, to not only do this once, but something like, you know, maybe seven times. I mean, that's a really powerful magical number. And this is the point where Slughorn gets very uncomfortable with the idea of this conversation. And not only that, you know, during this whole thing, it's bringing back to Harry's mind these things that he heard, you know, nearly 2 years ago, where Voldemort is talking about how he was ripped from his body and he was less than a spirit. He's less than a ghost, but he was still alive. And so this is where, you know, she brings the second book, the fourth book, and this book all together to really kind of explain, and even the first book, to kind of bring all of this together as to exactly what Voldemort has been up to. And as we exit the memory, it's going to get worse for Harry, because he is still kind of thinking that Voldemort has only done this once, and Dumbledore talking through this with Harry, they're going to come to see that no, that the whole plan here was for him to do this 7 times.
Right. Well, 6, because there should be 7 pieces, yes, right? Yes. So the intent was to create 6 additional pieces, which I think he clarified. I also found it interesting. It actually tied in pretty much all of the books, because we hear about the groundskeeper when we're talking about one of the Horcruxes. We hear about we literally this chapter ties all of the books, some element of all of the books that we've read so far together. And I found it so interesting because I think we've actually talked about 7 being a magical number in other chapters. It wasn't quite as notable, but the fact that 7 is meant to be this incredibly powerful magical number, and that's why he picked the number he picked. But yeah, I mean, we kind of go through the list, right? You've got the diary, which we'll talk about in a second. You've got the ring. We start talking about that was part of why Voldemort wanted to come back to Hogwarts, was to find more of his sort of treasures or his trophies from his conquer. And that it has to be a conscious decision when you kill someone. It's not just anytime you kill someone, your soul gets split. It's that anytime you kill someone, you have the opportunity to split your soul if you do this, you know, this magical spell alongside it. Which I think is also important to note here. But one of the things that came up before we get too much of the weeds, we're probably going to go a little out of order, so bear with us, is this idea that Nagini is one of the Horcruxes. Okay. So in book 4, we get to that where he kills the man in the shack, and that's the idea, is that's where Nagini was created as a Horcrux, right? So even well into the series, we're still creating Horcruxes, at least in this theory world. But, you know, they talk about whether using a sentient being is usually a good idea for that. And if we talk about other fandoms, as we pull in here, we know that Nagini's, you know, a unique snake, right? But it's a really interesting conversation because, you know, we come to find that it's just, you know, Dumbledore's noting like they have a closer relationship. You know, Nagini listens to Voldemort even more than a regular snake would, and has an almost human-like characteristic. And he's chalking that up to the fact that, Voldemort put part of his soul into the snake. Which, by the way, is my least favorite character in this entire series. And I struggle to watch any scene with Nagini for both the human reason and the fact that I hate snakes.
Well, and I
Movie 2 is a nightmare for me.
Oh, I can imagine. I think it's so interesting, you know, now in light of the Fantastic Beasts series, because of, you know, what we know of these characters. And specifically, you know, you have the relationship of Nagini with Grindelwald and, of course, Clarence. And so, you know, it's fascinating to me the way that they have, played this out. And I'm just really excited then to see how that series plays out in light of this. But, you know, like you were saying, there's so much of the way that this connects. So, you know, Dumbledore is able to convince Harry that the reason that there are more than one Horcrux is because the way that Voldemort treated the Horcrux of the diary and the fact that he would have entrusted that to Lucius. He obviously never told Lucius exactly what it was, other than it had something to do with opening the Chamber of Secrets. And then, of course, you know, Lucius being Lucius uses it for his own personal gain. And of course, that's why Lucius is in so much trouble now with Voldemort in the first place. you know, we learn about, like you said, Nagini. We learn about why the fact that Voldemort would not be interested in something like the Philosopher's Stone, even though he was after it in the first book. It's not something he would want to eternally have to be reliant on. You know, like, as Dumbledore says, you know, Voldemort likes to operate alone, and he doesn't want to have to rely on anything, even something like the elixir, so that would be intolerable to him. And this idea of making the seven Horcruxes was very important to him. So the cool thing here is that we learn that we've got two of them already destroyed. We have first the diary, and secondly, the ring that has hurt Dumbledore's hand. We finally learn why that happened, because it was a Horcrux. And Dumbledore had found it on his travels. And so we also learn one of the main reasons that Dumbledore has been leaving the castle so often this book is because he has been continuing his search for these Horcruxes. And so we believe that one of them was probably the Hufflepuff cup. We know one of them's Nagini. And then that means it's probably something Ravenclaw and Gryffindor that is also a Horcrux, as well as most likely the locket. So the other thing that makes me so angry about this not being in the movie is that the movie leaves you no idea what the other Horcruxes are, whereas here, we pretty much know everything we're searching for except for one, which is it something Gryffindor or is it something Ravenclaw? We don't know. But we do such a great job of really filling this in. And she really brings everything together here. And so I think this is really fascinating. But beyond all of this, we also talk about the idea of, you know, if all of the Horcruxes are destroyed, then we can destroy then finally Voldemort. But that's great, but it's still going to be very difficult. As Dumbledore says, you know, yes, he'll be weakened, but he still has the mind and the power of one of the most powerful wizards of all time. So this is still not going to be an easy task. In fact, it just sounds more Herculean than ever.
Right. I think it's so interesting because I think we get a little indication with the leftover Horcruxes that it's more likely to be a Ravenclaw item than a Gryffindor. I think part of that is just history we know between Slytherin and Gryffindor, and that was sort of the downfall of the original founders, right? Is that relationship. But also because, you know, Dumbledore sort of indicates that he has the most treasured artifact of Gryffindor, gesturing to the sword of Gryffindor, right? And basically indicating that that is safe and is not a Horcrux. So it's likely not something of Gryffindor. But it doesn't completely rule it out. He's not being arrogant, but it is definitely much more enlightening, and we definitely break down and put a lot more pieces together here than we do in the movie. And so it is nice that we get those dots connecting, and we get sort of an excited Dumbledore, right? Like this checks a lot of boxes for him. He gets a little jazzed, right? If you ever want to know what Dumbledore is like, jazzed. He's like got his little internal jazz hands going. And so I think it's really interesting how that sort of plays out here. And I do love how he logics his way through a lot of this, right? When you talked a little bit about Lucius and how he gave the diary to him and how he wouldn't be so cavalier with the other half of his soul. And I think that's a great just logic-based assumption. And I do love how we also call out before we move too far past it, how he indicates that Lucius is probably happy he's safer in Azkaban than he is not in Azkaban at this point. But it also, you know, we started this book out with the Malfoy family, including Bellatrix Lestrange, right? We start with them and with Snape. And I think knowing what Lucius did had such an impact that he lost a Horcrux adds to the that Voldemort literally lost his mind about it. I mean, they talk about how angry he got when he heard what happened to it. That just really paints an even greater picture of how desperate the Malfoy family is. Like, the it feeds into their story as well, which I think we forget about. And they're somewhat of a villain in this story. You don't want to empathize with them. But it does give you a little more insight into maybe why Draco feels the way he does about his own mission, right? Because his father's already failed Voldemort, and Lord knows he doesn't want to do the same.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think what I love about this chapter is, again, it's really bringing the whole series together in a lot of ways. And, you know, I mentioned specifically, and I did it on purpose, you know, at the beginning here, this idea of that this chapter kind of parallels very much the Lost Prophecy, because the end of this chapter is us talking about the prophecy and expounding on that idea and helping Harry completely understand it now. And he's had a good understanding, but now I think he has a complete understanding after this conversation. And Dumbledore's trying to explain to him and get through his head, which is, it's very difficult. Dumbledore actually gets very agitated in this whole section. He's frustrated because he can't make Harry understand. And you know, you can see there's a sense of relief for Dumbledore by the end of this chapter when Harry finally does get it. And it's this idea that by choosing Harry, by listening to the prophecy and choosing Harry, that Voldemort has basically created his own worst enemy. And in that, it's because Harry has the ability to love. And, you know, Harry just throws that off as that's not important. But Dumbledore says, you're not old enough to understand, and we've talked about this so many times, just how special you are, that you are the person that you are. And that you are not a person who has ever been tempted by the dark side of things. And Harry's like, of course I haven't. He killed my mom and dad. And he said, exactly. Don't you see you've been, you know, protected by your ability to love? The person that you are is the very thing that makes you Voldemort's worst enemy. And he did it to himself by making the prophecy true with you, and then all of the repercussions that happened because of that, that he did not expect. And it's just so beautiful, because there's this wonderful moment of Rowling really bringing into focus how evil really ends up defeating itself and making itself its own worst enemy. And here we have that scene, and the fact that Harry Potter is Voldemort's nemesis because he created his own nemesis.
Well, and I love too that he basically talks about it, you know, he turns it around, and this was the part where it really clicked as the message was going through. Like, this is to me where Harry went, oh, the light bulb turned on, was both the part you're talking about where he kind of says, like, even if you had no prophecy, there was nothing there, would you still choose to defeat him the way you have? And he goes, well, yeah, right? That's one, I think, click moment for him. But the other one is where he sort of turns it around and explains that the prophecy doesn't matter to Harry because Voldemort has fulfilled that prophecy, but Harry doesn't have to do any, like, the prophecy doesn't affect Harry, right? He explained it in the back way, like, Voldemort is tied now to this prophecy, but Harry's not. And Harry's strength is the fact that doing the right thing is what ties him to this whole mess, right? And that he's been pulled into it, and then he shows up. So it's something, I think he says something along the lines of, like, Voldemort is dragged along and forced to follow this prophecy. You have the power of showing up the way you want to show up in this setting because you're not being forced to participate. You're choosing to participate. And I think it really kind of puts in perspective for Harry that along those lines that, like, he's not the chosen one in terms of, like, he has to do this. He has to do this because he wants to do, the very essence of who he is wants to do this, not because a prophecy told him to do it. And that his motivation and his sense of being is the reason why he's showing up, right? And that is so much stronger and so much more beneficial than someone doing it out of fear or doing it because they have to do it because a prophecy said that was the case, right? And I think that too kind of turned it on his head a little bit for him, is that he's not controlled by the prophecy, but Voldemort is, right? I think that gave him a little bit of a leg up and understood why it's so different.
Well, and it was fascinating too, because, you know, Dumbledore goes through all these ideas like, look, Voldemort's fault. It's Voldemort's fault that you were able to see into, you know, his thoughts. You have some of his ambitions, that you understand snake language. And despite all of this, you know, you're not tempted at all by the power that he has because of what that power did to you. And so, again, it's this whole, like, there's just, it's kind of a weird, like, almost predestination thing going on, and it's fascinating, and the way she does it is so perfect. And I love the way that Harry thinks about this idea of, you know, that in the end, he understands what Dumbledore is trying to say, that this is the difference between being dragged into the arena for a fight and walking into the arena with your head held high.
Right.
Both ways you end up in the arena, but how you get there is different. And, you know, I think it's just a really beautiful moment here where we have Harry finally crystallize exactly who he is, why he is, and everything that's been driving. Like, Harry, I think, finally kind of even understands his own motivations for doing all this for the first time in his life, in a way that truly makes sense. And I think, you know, one of the most exciting things for him, too, is that, you know, Dumbledore tells him that he's very close to finding what he thinks is a hiding place for the Horcrux. And Harry asks him if he can go with him. And Dumbledore says yes. So Harry is being made a part of this journey in a way that he's never been before. You know, he was able to solve the riddle of how to talk to the Slughorn to get the memory. And now he's being offered the opportunity to be able to go with Dumbledore to find the next Horcrux. And so, man, this book just got way more exciting.
Well, and I think this chapter, too, sort of a weird thing. This is one of the first times where Harry's actually given a choice and have to do anything, right? The essence of who, of course, he's going to make that choice, but he's not... The Chosen One has always thrust him into a position he doesn't want to be. And this is the first time someone's, I think, telling him he can choose to be this person, right? And to follow the dark path. And for him, there was never a choice. He can choose now to go and help Dumbledore. He gets a voice. We've talked about it a few times. I've brought it up that they keep treating him like a child. Like, he doesn't have a say. He doesn't get to participate. He's just kind of told what to do and how to be. And this is kind of you can have a choice. You get a choice. And that, I think, is also where he's a man. He goes from boy to man in this chapter.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it. I really like that. And what I think makes this so exciting is to see where, you know, we're going to go next, because the end of this book is right here now. And I can't wait. You know, this is such a great chapter. Super, super excited. You know, the way this picks up, and again, I think the way this chapter just is able to bring so many different threads together. You know, I feel like we just put in a bunch of puzzle pieces into the puzzle. And
this is like when you complete the edging to your puzzle.
Yes. I like that.
Right? You finally put all the edge pieces and the corner pieces together, and you have like the framework. And now there's all the stuff in the middle, and you're actually kind of starting to make a little bit of progress towards that middle section. You're like, oh, yeah, no, I see where that goes now. Like, now you're in that like puzzle groove.
Yeah.
I'm
right there with you. I love puzzles, and I'm excited that we're continuing to just put this one together. So before we head into the next week and the next chapter, Drea, where can everybody catch up with you?
If you want to send me virtual Rice Krispie treats, you can find me on Twitter at PCFChick or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's C-O-F-F-M-A-N.
And you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero, under the name MattRushing02, here on the network doing Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. You can find me on the Trek FM network doing two shows. One I do is called The Orb. We do that with I do that with Chris Jones as we talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Also doing the 602 Club with my friend Chrissy and other hosts as we talk about all of the different fandoms we love. There are so many, so we don't limit it to just one. You can also find me doing cinema stories with my good friend Courtney as we do talk about films through the lens of faith. But thank you so much for checking your outposts.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.